Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the third session, the third discussion on wisdom from sutra passages. So we have selected Anusaya Sutra from the Anguttara Nikaya of the Pali Canon today. So it is such a short sutra. First of all, let me read it out for recording purpose. Monks, with the abandoning and destruction of the seven obsessions, the holy life is fulfilled. Which seven? The obsession of sensual passion, Kamaraga. The obsession of resistance, Patigha. The obsession of views, Ditti. The obsession of uncertainty, Vichikicha. The obsessions of conceit, Mana. The obsession of passion for becoming, Bhavaraga. The obsession of ignorance, avijja. With the abandoning and destruction of these seven obsessions, the holy life is fulfilled. When, for a monk, the obsession of sensual passion has been abandoned, its root destroyed, made like a palmyra stump, deprived of the conditions of development, not destined for future arising, when, for him, the obsession of resistance, etc., the obsessions of view, the obsessions of uncertainty, the obsessions of conceit, the obsessions of passion for becoming. The obsession of ignorance has been abandoned, its root destroyed, made like a palmyra stump, deprived of the conditions of development, not destined for future rising. This is called a monk who has cut through craving, has turned away from the fetter, and by rightly breaking through conceit, has put an end to suffering and stress. Now, I would like to touch on the historical background of this sutra and many other sutras. Now, Buddha has given a number of sutras, number of teachings based on purity. Now, in the mainstream society that he was born raised and lived his life both as a prince and afterwards as the Buddha. Purity was one of the mostly heard, mostly mentioned terms in his time. Now, one famous thing is in his society. He was born Hindu, I would say, even though the word Hindu wasn't in use that time. Because it's a tricky word, as we discussed the last time too. It was a Brahminical religion. So according to Brahminical religion, so purity, in Brahminical spirituality, the term purity corresponds to washing of sins in the Ganges, the holy river. Now, it's always considered purity is seen as a physical action, purifying your body, even to this day, actually. I also followed my Hindu friends. I went to India. So I took few dips in the Ganges and few other rivers early in the morning, around 3 a.m. In 3 a.m. Because they asked me to go and then I tried it because I just want to experience it. Now, Buddha borrowed the same Brahminical terms and then reinterpreted them. Now, he has to use Sanskrit or Prakrit words. Right? Prakrit is the kind of language that he spoke. Sanskrit is the language of the elite, spoken by Brahmins. And then a lot of religious people like the founder of Jainism, Mahavira, and Buddha, Gautama, and many other Shramanic teachers. There were two traditions, Brahminical tradition, that was the Hindu or Brahminical religion, and then Shramanic traditions were the other tradition. Now, there were lots of religious groups. They were all Shramanic. They were on the opposite camp. Now, most of Shramanic teachers, they chose a Prakrit language. Sanskrit literally means specifically formed, made, designed for the elite for pure spiritual purpose. For example, when you read Sanskrit dramas, I study Sanskrit dramas for my my senior high school. Now, according to that drama, so Brahmins speak in Sanskrit. Kings are allowed to do that. However, untouchables, according to the caste system, they are the Shudras, untouchables. Now, they would always communicate. They were supposed to understand Sanskrit, but they were not supposed to answer in Sanskrit. They were supposed to answer in the Prakrit language. There are about 12, 13 Prakrit languages. And they were more like dialects. So I had to study 12 for my final year in the bachelor's degree. So you could they're more like they were not independent languages. They were like dialects of the same language. Prakrit, Sanskrit is specifically designed, made for a special purpose, that is to be used by elite Brahmins for Vedic chanting and all this. Whereas Prakrit means language of the common people. Krit means in Sanskrit is Kruta, meaning made. Pra, for people. Made for the people. So Buddha used Pali. Of course, there are differences of opinion as to what Pali means. Anyway, he spoke a Magadhi language. They're called the Prakrit languages. I was going to say, now, however, all the Sanskrit is considered the mother language. Now, all the Prakrit languages borrowed a lot from Sanskrit. So when Buddha borrowed the same terms, he reinterpreted them. Reinterpreted them because there was no way to coin new terms. He has to. And he borrowed certain cultural concepts. He borrowed lots of terms and they reinterpreted to mean. So that is whenever one definition, one main big definition that he gave, throughout his teachings, is the term purity. What he meant by purity. And then, so purity, just like Nirvana, just like many other practices, are internalized in Buddhism. They are called internalized. What is called internalized meaning? Now, internalized means in terms of cosmic reality, for example. Now, salvation is a cosmic reality according to Brahminical religion. It is somewhere in the space, like heaven. Now, Buddha internalized salvation, calling it, no, it is in your mind. The same way he internalized purity, no, it is not in the Ganges. It has nothing, water cannot clean, wash off your sins. You need to cleanse your mind. So internalize, this is called internalization. But he was never against those practices. He simply borrowed some terms, and so Buddha was one who never liked arguments or debates. He respected others. That is why whenever Buddha walked to a community that was comprised of non-Buddhists, of course, Buddhist is a funny term, because Buddhist actually. He was comprised of followers other than those of the Buddha, and everybody would stop their talking and they would welcome him and say, he prefers silence. He prefers silence, let's stop talking and we must listen to him. It's always good to listen to a silent man. Not to a man who always talks. So that's when this is purity, one big term that the Buddha borrowed. I'm not going to touch on the Pali words here. One big term that he borrowed. Purity. However, at certain time, Buddha was humorous too. He used humor. Now, even after enlightenment, nowadays scientists say that there are certain brain cells that govern humor, our humor. So that, and in Abhidharma, in Buddhist psychology, you come across feelings of humor. And upon enlightenment, you never lose your humor. And Buddha used humor. But humor has to be non-offensive. So, and then in elsewhere, in another sutra, Buddha says, now, if you can wash off your sins so that you get purified, so that you can achieve salvation, what about the fish and frogs or other beings who are born in the water? Aren't they enlightened? Don't they come to birth with innate, built-in enlightenment? Like they are automatically enlightened? But nobody felt offensive though. With other, you know, always there were intellectual people, and people would laugh, and then Buddha would appreciate humor. Now, it is very rarely though. I think I have never come across someone who felt offended by Buddha's humor. Now here, this is another key word. Actually, see, according to the sutra, you know, that the translation of anusaya. Anusaya is the Pali term, that the sutra's name. Anusaya literally means obsession. There are different translations. Obsessions, Tanissaro Bhikkhu and some others use obsession. And if you need a more modern layman psychological term, that is latent tendencies. Latent tendencies. Now, what is nirvana? Nirvana is something that we don't know yet. So it is unknown to us. Now, when Buddha was asked what is unknown, and he would disregard the idea of creator, the cosmos, universe, etc. And Buddha would simply divert people's attention would say that what is unknown is within you. What is unknown to you is within you. And then once you come to know the unknown aspect of your being, you are at nirvana. And it is based on self-realization. Now, lots of Westerners and some intellectual, some Asian Buddhists also, they love the word self-realization. Now, you can separate your nirvana from yourself. What you realize yourself in the name of nirvana or salvation is your own self. So nirvana is self-realization. However, on the cultural level, some Buddhists, I have come across lots of people, even some of my close relatives, they always separate nirvana from their being. And they want to move up there somewhere, like in the cosmos or another landscape or something. It's like another domain. Okay, I should go there. And that's why when people talk about nirvana in a lot of Asian languages, and they would say, we all need to go to nirvana. Go to nirvana. There's no going. There's no going. That's no going. Because my American friends, you know, in America, they use always, it's warnings, and they say, sir, right? Sir, there's no going. yes, we're going
to
see.
Did the Buddha teach that there were heavens to go to, but
yeah,
it's within samsara?
Right? Within samsara, yes. Within samsara.
And maybe that, when people think about some positivity up there.
Exactly, yeah.
Nirvana may be like a heaven.
Exactly, heaven, yeah. And further, some people believe that, you know, of the 16 Brahma worlds, so non-sensual, they are called spiritual heavens. They are not sensual heaven, they are spiritual heavens. And the five topmost spiritual heavens are, they are called Brahma lokas. Loka is the world, Brahma lokas. The top five are called the pure abodes. Pure abodes. Aviha, Atappa, Sudassa, Sudassi, Akanittaka. They are the topmost five. And later, the teaching of the five abodes contributed immensely towards the idea of pure land in Chinese Buddhism. Yeah, because once you when you pass, having attained some jhanas, psychic abilities, you will be reborn into, and plus some lower levels of enlightenment, you will be reborn into one of those five pure abodes. Because the lifespan is so long, it is almost like you are going to be there like forever in order to complete the rest of the stages of enlightenment. And that created a sense that if nirvana is within us, but a better place would be the pure abodes. And I know some people, they really want to go to pure abodes and they stay there for some time, and then they would always justify that, you know what, they are not sensual heavens. They are spiritual heavens. So, and then they asked me whether it's okay, Bhante. I said, why not? It's okay. It is better to go there, way better to go to the spiritual heavens than hells. Right? So what guarantees, what we need to guarantee for ourselves is, because we don't know when we're going to achieve our nirvana, we are always encouraged to stay on the safe side of samsara. But otherwise, all those heavens are, even spiritual heavens, are still part of samsara. Now, the Buddhist cosmology is understood in terms of samsara. Now, if you are enlightened, if you get enlightened today, and then most of you will remain above all those gods. Why? Even though they are divine beings, because they are not enlightened, if they are not enlightened, they are samsaric beings. You exist for the rest of your life, you will remain beyond samsara. So because you don't have any attachments. And then Carl Jung also, but he always loved the Buddhist taste, I would say, unlike Sigmund Freud. Now, I have always seen parallels with the Buddha's description of the unknown and the unknown that Carl Jung talks about in Jungian psychology. He also says that the biggest problem that we people, human, have faced is to know what we are. As long as we realize what we are, as long as we fail to realize what we are, we continue to suffer. Now that statement sounds very Buddhist to me. So, and then the purity. Now, when it comes to the unknown, and Buddha talks about the seven aspects of the unknown, which are the anusayas here. Anusaya literally means dormant. Dormant. Because it's dormant, that's why I use the word latent. They are called dormant tendencies, or the latent tendencies, or the obsessions. Obsession is used to give a sense of how these seven anusayas affect our daily life. Because it's more like a layman's term, obsessions. Because we feel, when we are obsessed with something, we feel it. But what really matters is that we may not be able to identify the root cause of our obsessions. All obsessions more or less come from a number of these seven tendencies. They are called anusaya or dormant or latent because they remain unknown to us. Now, those are the seven pillars of the unknown self. Because known self is a reflection. The known part of the self is a reflection. Now they are like behind they are behind the curtain. Now so it takes sometimes we don't know why we get obsessed with certain things. Of course you would say, well, we start with simple desire, later we get addicted. Once addicted, we hit the red zone. We find it difficult to have a U-turn, even though we feel like. So that is when I use in drug addiction counseling when I work with the Canadian Federal Police and the states also with the police departments. I always, they ask me whether it's okay to give a medical dose of marijuana, medical dose of drugs to addicts. What about the Buddhist idea? I say, no, you know what? What matters is the motive. In case they get sick, they fall ill when they are not given, because their body find it difficult to get adjusted to a life that is drugs free, it's okay for, as a Buddhist, I would always say that it's good to give them a medical dose of whatever the drug they are already addicted to. Now, because it's an obsession, then it's obsessive.
We are until
we get obsessed, and somebody tells us, yes. Somebody shows us why, somebody comes in a dialogue and says, "Hey, this is what is happening to you. This is what has happened to you." Until somebody comes over and convinces us, we wouldn't know why we behave in a certain way. That's why they are called unknown, latent, or anusaya, or the dormant tendency. Let's say the Buddha uses word. See that analogy here, the analogy of palmyra stump, and palmyra, you know, the palmyra, the trees of palmyra, you know, when it is, let's say, like a coconut tree, when the top part of a coconut tree is broken away by heavy winds or like a cyclone, it doesn't grow back. So that's why this palmyra stump analogy is heavily used in. So once you cut off the top part of the palmyra, it doesn't regrow. It can grow. Unlike in other trees. Now, this analogy Buddha has used, the destruction of why it is important to destroy all our latent tendencies. However, elsewhere Buddha said this it takes the longest time to do this. Nobody is able to do this, to destroy these latent tendencies overnight. See, it took Siddhartha Bodhisattva like many eons, many millions of lifetimes to get enlightened. Why is that? We are called paramita. Why did he have to run through different life forms, even as a Bodhisattva? Because the biggest struggle he had as a Bodhisattva is to study and understand the unknown self. The unknown part of that. Now, so, and it's always tricky too. Now, when I meet someone, I feel like helping a needy person. Right? But there's no guarantee that I build up an unhealthy, improper relationship with the party that I am helping. Unless I watch myself. Sometimes in the absence of the party that you've been helping for many years, and you feel distressed. Why? You need to meet that person. That is when you would know that halfway through your helping process that you got some attachment to that person. Probably you have a sensual relationship with that party. It takes us a long time to know, to understand whether the connections that we make amount to obsessions. Yes.
So you said Bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. It's more of a Mahayana.
Right, yeah. In Theravada also we told Bodhisattvas.
You do as well?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. So that is why in traditional terms, in Theravada we talk about three types of Bodhisattvas. A Bodhisattva who aspired to be a Sammasambuddha, a pioneering Buddha, and he would come to the world and he would pioneer the rediscovery of Dhamma, truth, Sammasambuddha. And there are other Paccheka Buddhas, or all enlightened Buddhas, but they are unable to enlighten others. and they appear in the world, there can be more than one. According to Buddhist Sutra, there were some, in one time there were 500 Paccheka Buddhas. Paccheka is a funny term. Paccheka means leading one way. They are called private Buddhas. They get enlightened themselves, but they are unable, not in a position to enlighten others. That's called one-way Buddhas. But, and another, they are, so the Bodhisattvas who want to be a Paccheka Buddha, and it takes much less time in samsara. And the shortest time is a disciple Buddha, Savaka Buddha. A disciple Buddha is one who wants to get enlightened in the company of Sammasambuddha. They are called arahats. Arahats in Buddhist terms. But however, in Pali itself, we come back with three types of Buddhas. Sammasambuddha, Paccheka Buddha, Savaka. Savaka means disciple Buddha. So what those three types of Buddhas implies is that there are three bodhisattvas. So even though you come back with that canonical term Savaka Buddha, however, in Theravada Buddhism, out of deep respect to Buddha, ordinary people are reluctant to call themselves Savaka Buddha, someone aspiring to be a Savaka Buddha, because they don't want to touch the term Buddha. So simply they would say, I want to be a disciple of the Buddha, so that I need to listen to him and to get enlightened by him. But what that implies is that they want to be a Savaka Buddha. But they are also bodhisattvas, three types of bodhisattvas. And then first one is sensual passion, kamaraga. First one, this is the most powerful obsession, kamaraga. Kama is sensual, passion is raga. Raga also implies sexuality. Now, in Buddhist, according to Buddhist psychology, the term sensuality and sexuality are almost like synonyms, because any sensual feeling would contain a bit of a modicum or an iota of sexuality too, because it's raga involved. Now, it's not necessarily, raga is not sexual feelings, but the word raga is used in a broader sense in Buddhism. But Buddha never denies the fact that raga underlies sexuality too. Now, for example, when you see, a modern car design or an aeroplane, right? Sometimes people would, I think we touch upon this few months ago. You know, some people call, I love this latest car, this brand, because the car looks sexy. The aeroplane is sexy. So that's why people use the term. And it is very Buddhist, because we had the whole seminar on the term sexy in our university in Miami. And there were a lot of professors with this presentation. They said it goes very well with the Buddhist definition of raga. No, raga is not necessarily sexual, but people derive their sexual desire not with the partner, but also with other obsessions, like some artists. Some artists, they don't have partners. They derive their sensual feelings out of something that they create. Some derive sensual feelings out of their body image, like bodybuilders. And anyone, when we step into teenage years, and lots of people spend more time in the bathroom, in front of the mirror, they observe their body, self-image, self-raga. And some people are so obsessed with their body, they don't need a partner, actually. That's called self-raga. Raga with yourself. So that's how raga is explained. That's how raga is understood in Buddhism, and it's also what's called sensual passion. Raga, but here it's a direct translation is sensual passion, kama raga. Actually, passion all raga also means desire, also lust. Another direct translation is lust. Lustful affection with the things that we see. Lustful affection with the things that we see. We get obsessed with things. I visited one of my friend's house in Canada, in the province of Alberta. So everything is, all the furniture is very tall in his house. Very tall. So you would see anything, a chair, you know, the handles, anything. And the standing lamps and all these things, and even the bulbs, they're all tall. Then I asked him, well, I am obsessed with anything that is tall. Anything that is tall. And his younger daughter is obsessed with anything circular. Anything circular. But that is very, I use those, their perception actually. Now, raga is about shapes, visual shapes. Visual raga is based on visual shapes. So some people have sabda raga, some people have the audio raga. Some people only like deep voices, only a deep voice. Some only like a children's voice.
But can I just say that, because in Western philosophy, there's a whole branch of philosophy which is dealing with aesthetics.
Yeah.
So, you know, people can talk for hours about how, like, a piece of architecture is beautiful, the proportions are so well balanced and everything, but they're not getting sexually aroused.
No, that's not. That's the whole point here too. But Buddhism has a different definition of sexuality. That's the point.
But
it's a different definition.
But what I thought you were saying is that every single sensual response is really a sexual.
Yeah, that's another problem there, etymologically. In the West, sensuality means something way different than what is meant by Buddhism. So that is why still there's no proper translation for sensuality.
Is this related to five senses? Like about addiction to food and stuff?
Is that
karma
that's,
raga?
That's karma raga too. Yeah. Addiction to food, that's karma raga. Addiction to music, karma raga. Computer games, karma raga. The best example I know is my brother. He married twice, he didn't go for honeymoon. The only way he said, I derive all my sexual feelings out of the, he was a sculptor. He could, Athena, all the Greek goddesses, and they are on display in 5-star hotels in Sri Lanka. And then he said, the only thing I need is, because I put all my raga into this statue. So I reflect myself on the statue. So I don't need the sexual partner. So I interviewed like 51 bodybuilders and artists. They are not interested in sexuality.
But I don't think they were practicing, let's say, abstract art. If you're an abstract painter, you don't care about the physical body. You're just trying to match the colours.
Yeah, I only interviewed those who are romantic artists.
Yeah, but I don't think they would get sexually aroused by
people. Not aroused. No, not sexually aroused. That's why the problem with the Buddhist term and the Western understanding. That's why there are so many papers and conferences on what is sexuality. There has been no consensus when it comes to the definition of sexuality in the West or in Greek-Roman culture and sexuality in Buddhism. In sexuality, anything is sexual according to karma raga. If there's an alternative ways of satisfying your senses, like, for example, my elder brothers. And then so he said, no, I don't have anything. I don't need any part or nothing. And he died of a brain hemorrhage. he told me in personal diary, I never made love with someone. I never wanted. So that was his obsession. So that's why there's no middle ground to see how sensuality or sexuality is deemed in non-Buddhist things. But I think Carl Jung or someone talks about the psychic erection. Psychic erection. That's a big, it happens to a lot of big meditators too. I have a lot of Buddhist monks and teachers. They get not physical erection, they get psychic erection. It has nothing to do with your physical organs. They are inner body, inner being gets sexually aroused, but it has nothing to do with your physical sexual arousal. That's called psychic arousal. And Buddha has given a warning. Don't lose your balance to your psychic arousal. So you feel, and it is an inner psychic tendency, actually. So that is also raga.
Is that when people are practicing the jhanas that they're
getting? Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right, exactly. So sometimes sexual arousal can be detrimental to jhanas.
Hmm.
Because jhanas are a selection of built-in tendencies that you spiritually enhance. So jhanas, because you don't create new tendencies to practice for jhana. You choose a number of innate tendencies that you develop further that would be turned into psychic abilities called jhanas. So that is why people have jhana but no stage of enlightenment achieved. They may easily lose their jhanas. One beautiful story is there was one young monk. He had jhanas and he was able to fly in the sky and he would travel. He would be able to perform psychic travel. When one day he was traveling in the air and down there was a beautiful river. There were beautiful girls bathing in that. And so that he happened to look down. He saw them. On purpose, he looked at them the second time. When he did that on purpose, there was intention, volition involved. He slowly lost his psychic ability and he landed. That's the story. Yeah, he lost it. Yeah, so and the Devadatta, it happened to Buddha's enemy Devadatta too. Devadatta used his jhanas to impress King Ajatasattu, who later murdered his father, Bimbisara. And as a result of that, he lost jhanas. Devadatta lost his jhanas. So that is when Buddha warns that jhanas are very important because they are spiritual advancements. However, and Buddha warns against getting addicted to jhanas too, because they are still worldly.
Buddha practice,
yeah. Exactly, well, yeah. Yeah. But if you are enlightened, if you are enlightened, then you never lose your jhanas. Why? Because your enlightenment can override the temporary nature of jhanas. With your enlightenment, your jhanas also become permanent. So spiritual enlightened people never lose their jhanas. Whereas those who have jhanas but not yet enlightened, they may lose their jhana. That's what happened to that young monk. And in another story also, one teacher, a senior monk, he had this student who was like 7 years old. Now, his teacher always wanted to impress his student and others. But the teacher didn't know that his novice monk, the 7-year-old monk, was already fully enlightened. One day he wanted to teach his teacher a lesson, a good lesson. And so he approached his teacher, "Guru, can you create an elephant with your psychic powers?" "Okay, there you go. Okay, look at that. There's an elephant. Can you make the elephant look like fierce?" "Of course." "Now, can you make the elephant now is going to run towards us to attack us?" Yes. And can you please keep watching of the elephant now coming, running towards us? And then now, instantaneously, the guru monk lost his jhanas because he got frightened by his own psychic creation. And then he started perspiring and shivering. And then the novice monk advised him, "Sir, if you stop, don't enjoy jhanas. You have to move forward and get enlightened. Once you are enlightened, it doesn't matter you have jhanas or not. But one thing is, if you only have jhanas and you don't try for enlightenment, you may easily lose them." So, and then the guru respected his students, and thereafter the guru would get advice from his 7-year-old student. There are a lot of jhana stories. Jhana stories in Buddhist scripture. So the second one is obsession of resistance, and it comes from the root of anger. Now, why only obsession of resistance? Why is resistance is considered a dormant tendency? Because there are different types of anger. There are different types of anger, but this is the more subtle one. This one. This is so subtle that it always goes unnoticed. There are other types of anger, like, for example, sudden burst of anger. That's called kodha, sudden burst of anger. A lot of big people fall from their position, fall from their grace because of sudden burst of anger. That's called kodha. And there's an hatred. Hatred continues through lifetimes, maybe through the samsara. There's a longer-lasting anger, that is hatred. And there's another one called ill will, silent anger. You wish that somebody get killed, somebody lose their valuables, somebody encounter trouble. That's ill will. This one, Patiga is the more subtle, this is the unknown type of anger. When you have the other types of anger, you feel it. When you have sudden burst of anger, krodha, you shiver in anger, and so that you can control. And then when you have ill will, you have difficulty sleeping at night. You might even get insomnia because of your ill will towards someone. So your entire life could be in trouble if you have hatred. Because hatred, according to Buddhist definition, can last beyond this lifetime. All those types, other types of anger, you can very easily feel it. Whereas resistance is obsessive. Resistance, this is the most subtle form of anger. Those who have patiga, the obsessions of the resistance, obsession of resistance, they don't feel it. A lot of spiritual people have this anger. They have this. Despite the fact they have meditated like 50, 30, 75 over time, almost their life. How to notice that patiga is there, for example. Say, if I am a meditator, of course I am, let's say. Now when you keep asking me questions, and at a certain point I fail to answer your questions, right? Because I don't know how to answer. And I don't accept that I don't know the answer. Right? Instead, I smile and say, you know what? Oh, I love your questions. Oh, yeah, that's the way you must ask questions. I love your questions. Sometimes, I have some few teachers like that. At that point, I am using patika as my defense mechanism. I'm angry, but I don't show. I myself wouldn't notice that either. And you wouldn't notice that at all. So, and some people use patiga, resistance, as a leadership quality. It is part of their leadership. And Buddha calls patiga a slow, silent killer. Slow killer. Because those who have patiga, when they would love to They would like others to listen to them.
Banta, is it a form of delusion?
It is related. Actually, delusion runs through all these. At the last one, ignorance, avijja. Yeah, because avijja. Thank you for bringing that up. Because some of these tendencies work together, like twin tendencies. For example, the last one, obsession with ignorance, delusion, avijja, is considered the feeder tendency. It feeds every other tendency, avijja. It's like the dark, it's like the darkness, darkness in the room. Now, when you turn the lights off, you can't see anything, furniture, anything in this building, within this space. Why is that? When you turn the light off, furniture doesn't disappear. Beauty doesn't disappear. What matters is the darkness covers everything. So that is why one of the hardest concepts, hardest tendencies to understand is the last one, ignorance or delusion. Because this is the last one, is the feeder tendency. It feeds every other tendency. For example, if you go back to sensual passion, kama, raga. Now, let's say somebody has improperly behaving towards someone, and his friends would say, hey, you know what, my friend, you are not supposed to behave like that because you are too much. Don't embarrass the other party. You know what? She understands me, and she knows that I help her. There's nothing wrong. Now, the last tendency would always helps you justify your sensual passion. It helps you justify. No, I'm okay. So that's the nature of avijja, delusion. Let's look at the other one, obsession of vivus, ditti. Now, because ditti is very important, that in the Noble Eightfold Path, Buddha recommended that we start our Noble Eightfold Path with the first one, wrong, right view, sammaditti. Because when your view goes wrong, and then everything else can go wrong. Because when you act on a wrong view, every action that you take thereafter would return wrong results. So that is when ditti, some translate ditti as right understanding. Not right view, right understanding. Most Westerners use the word, when I teach children, I don't use the word right view, I use the word right understanding. Because when understanding is wrong, the next one is right samadhi, sammasankappa, right thoughts. Your thoughts could go wrong. So, for example, because I know this in dating counseling, I use some people. You know, some people try to commit suicide because they thought that for months they believed that the other party loved them. Because they were in their own misunderstanding. They had misunderstood the other party's friendship. So based on the wrong understanding, now they decided to move forward and to make more advance. Advance their feelings, and they go even and say propose. You know what? I would like to marry you. So most of the time it happens because when they use wrong view, the ditti, obsessions with ditti. But Buddha says, if there is something that is most detrimental to our well-being, is obsession of views. Now, when we are obsessed with views, we hardly let go of them. No matter how convincing someone's knowledge is, people, you know, in London itself, I know a few families, well-educated people, because of their obsession of ditti, they lost their partner, they lost their family, children, wives. Still they don't believe that. They say that, you know, they got to listen to me. They didn't listen to me. That's the only thing they would say. Seven families I know here. They still say, no, they should listen to me. Without them, without me, they can't survive. Actually, all those families are surviving better now. Without, so, but still, when I convinced, when I told them, you know what, but they are better off with without you. Are you saying that? No, that's what they say. I think they are wrong. No, I don't think they are happy. I say, no, that is your ditti. All those seven husbands, they are a fine ample example, obsession of ditti, obsession of views. Now, views, according to the commentaries of view or ditti, they are like, how to say, people get infatuated with ditti, intoxicated with ditti. They get infatuated with ditti. You don't need alcohol, according to sub-commentaries, to get infatuated. One strong ditti is good enough for you to get infatuated or get intoxicated. So once you get intoxicated, actually you are then, you are emotionally drunk.
Is that where, like, you know, you love to hear the sound of your own voice sort of thing, where you're very arrogant about your views better than others?
Exactly.
Like, by being drunk on it?
Exactly.
So is it like when you always think you're right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. You think always think you are right. You're always right. That is ditti. In other words, what Buddha uses is mother, M-A-D-A, mother. Mother, we will talk about five types of infatuations. Four types of infatuation, that's another sutra, probably next week we will talk about that. How people get intoxicated certain things in their lives. And so because once they get addicted, they never want to leave that. Because that is their expectations are solely based on those addictions or those infatuations.
What about faith that Buddhism is the truth? An obsession?
Oh, wait, what the?
Oh, yeah, very strong faith.
A faith, yeah, actually.
Buddhism is true, and
right. I come back.
But that sounds like a good thing to have.
Yeah,
wanna,
that's right.
Have strong faith.
Yeah. Now, the Buddha redefined it. Now, instead of bhakti, he recommended saddha. Bhakti is like a blind faith. So, whereas faith based on reasoning, that is the faith that Buddha recommends. Faith, rootless, what is that called?
Is it confidence rather than faith?
Exactly, confidence, yeah. But confidence or trust. So in order for you to trust someone, whatever they say must make sense. Otherwise, you can't trust them. Some scholars, especially, I think, Professor Rupert Getting, Bristol University, I had a long dialogue with him several times. His translation of saddha is affection with truth. Affection with truth. I like that translation. Affection with truth. Because we are supposed, we feel affectionate towards truth. That is why we like the Buddha. In order to do that, Buddha refused to identify himself as a teacher. Why? He lived in the guru culture. In guru culture, you have to go through the guru. Even for salvation, you don't get access to salvation unless you go through the guru. Now, there are a few Buddhist movements in Sri Lanka, and two famous movements. Now, when they preach, when their followers, they always quote their teacher as saying, according to our guru, not according to Buddha. According to our guru. One day I encounter someone saying, why don't you say, I just want to tease him, one of my friends in London. Why don't you say according to Buddha, according to the sutra? No, because there are different translations. We only accept the way our guru interprets it. And then I said, doesn't that mean that you have bhakti, like a blind faith, not confidence, not trust based on reasoning? And then he said, no, I only listen to my guru. But the thing is, guru culture, Buddha rejected guru cultures because guru cultures could become cultic. Buddha refused that. Buddha never wanted to his followers to be cultic. Within guru cultures, because you don't, that's what happened to gurus actually. So Buddha refused to identify himself as guru. He made a statement based on. When somebody asked who his guru was, and Buddha says, I don't have a guru. Are you a guru yourself? No, I'm not. Who is your guru? Dhamma is my guru. What I have realized is my guru. So, do you worship what you have achieved? No, I don't do that. So, why do you consider your own knowledge as your guru? Are you a slave to your own knowledge? No, it's not like that. Now, I don't identify myself as a guru so that followers don't come to me believing in me, believing in me. They don't get spiritually blindfolded before me. But why I don't, and at the same time, I don't identify myself as a guru, and I don't, at the same time, I give people full freedom to inquire and to examine, investigate what I say. So thereby, he attributed no authority to himself as a guru. He attributed no authority to his knowledge as something final or ultimate.
So that's why he didn't perform miracles, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. He never wanted that. Mm-hmm. When one arahat, Pindola Bharadwaja, performed miracles, and he asked him to come over, and then, so Buddha, please don't do that hereafter. So miracle of guidance. Not the psychic miracles. Because when you perform psychic miracle, people come to you not based on your wisdom, but because of your power. So he rejected psychic miracles. Instead, he recommended what is called miracles, the miracles of advice or guidance. Anusasana. Anusasana means literally admonition or guidance. So Buddha had to do that specifically. Why? He was the pioneer. Right? He had to show that he had zero authority, because he lived in a society where almost everyone claimed to be a guru and knew the truth, nothing but the truth. So Buddha never wanted to fall into one of those categories. Yes.
I'm thinking about the obsession of views.
Mm-hmm.
So when you meet somebody with an opposing view, what button does that push? Why do we invest so much in the views that we hold?
Yeah, and the Buddha says it's insecurity.
Insecurity.
Insecurity, and in order to be on the safe side and to safeguard your self-esteem, don't talk but listen.
Bhante, isn't it linked with Bhavaraga?
It's Bhavaraga, yes. That's right, Bhavaraga. Big, yeah, that's why, that's the...
If you don't hold a view...
Yeah, that's the...
Tightly.
Exactly, that's the sixth one.
Yeah.
Sixth obsession, Bhavaraga.
You said they come in twins, don't
mm-hmm.
sometimes?
Yeah, it's twins to Bhavaraga. Actually, Bhavaraga, now... Avijja is the feeder tendency in the subconscious mind. Now, so the Bhavaraga is the feeder tendency on the social level, on the conscious level, not on the subconscious level. Always Bhavaraga, that is passion for becoming or re-becoming. Because you are not happy with what you are, and you want to be something else. And being something else after something else and after something else never ends.
But sometimes that takes sticking to a view and not
exactly
not giving
that's
up.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's suddenly if you give that view up you
exactly
your
yeah.
whole personality starts
exactly,
evolving
yeah.
and your fear of
becoming yeah.
becomes
mm-hmm. yeah.
rather more real.
That's right. And some people remain lost for months or years. And it is really connected with your self-identity too. What am I? Who am I? Because
that's why people lock onto gurus.
Exactly. Always.
They would rather have someone else.
Someone else, yeah.
Set down the rules than
that's right,
to
yeah.
be left on their own.
Their own, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Working it out, investigating.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, inquiring.
Mm-hmm. Inquiring,
and
yeah.
That's very hard for some
yeah.
people.
And when people are unhappy with that, and they would create a parallel selfhood too. That's called fantasy self. Some people create their a parallel self out of their own existence, and it's me there, not the real one. So, and people they imagine being someone else, because in reality they find it difficult to believe or accept that what they are, because all the options, they have tried almost every option available to them, but that's no more. And so that they choose another as the last resort, some people. And it is well explained in psychiatry too.
Mental
health, yeah.
When you were saying it's difficult, you mean it's difficult to work it out by yourself?
Well, we've got many examples today of people following ideologies and whether it's political ideologies or other things, you know, where people feel they need to follow someone and because they find it hard to investigate for themselves. It's frightening to do it on your own for some people.
Mm.
They'd rather have a set of rules.
Example, if I went and I went to study art, I went to study how a great painter, a great painters are dead from the Victorian age, then I would want to go to a teacher and I want to investigate if that teacher's got the right skill. And if I think they've got the right skill and they can demonstrate that their teaching links back to the old masters, then I could sort of follow a set of instructions. But that's not going to be an obsession of you. I'm not going to grasp onto that. It does make a common sense way of practicing. But what's also interesting is the gurus themselves, they actually say, don't take what I say on faith. Question what I say.
Exactly, yeah.
So I don't think if you follow, if you are following a guru, if the guru is saying that and you're doing that, and you think, like the art teacher example, that they've got the skills, they've got some deeper knowledge that you don't have.
Right, yeah.
I think it's okay to follow.
Yeah, that's right. That's the case. But sometimes guru themselves get lost too. That's the whole point, actually.
Well, that's why you got five gurus.
Yeah. You know, when that comes, certain gurus who are good writers,
yeah.
the first book is their masterpiece, and then they reproduce a few more books out of the main book, and find most of the time the last book that they write or the last few lectures they give. And
that's the other thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that we...
Mm-hmm.
I would say before you follow anyone, be sure of your pursuit, of what you want out of it, because it's probably quite easy to just be led. It's probably easy to be led based on, you know, something that you believe might be true and honest.
That's
and
right,
pure,
yeah.
But actually it's coming from your own ignorance, I suppose.
That's right, yeah. And throughout his Buddha's teaching and that corresponds to Buddha's idea that he recommends study the Dhamma. That's called problem-based investigation, not theory-based investigation. Always choose your own problem to inquire. So you don't need to study the entire teachings of the Buddha or whichever the faith or religion that you believe in. Always based on your problem, try to find a solution to your problems. Now, and Buddha himself says that when someone, because Buddha's experience, by the time it reaches my ears, would have become theoretical to me because it's not my experience. He's sharing his experience with me. It doesn't become my experience. as long as I don't experience. So when your investigation is based on your own problem, this is called problem-based learning, not theory-based. There are some people who come and say, Bhante, I just want to learn something. What is that? All about Buddhism. Now, but there should be a starting point. What do you want to learn? Well, whatever the Buddha has taught, I mean, he has taught many things, and sometimes I would slowly divert their attention to their health issues, problem with their partners, job-related, etc. And then they, oh, you know what? Actually, I have lots of problems. Would you mind my asking you to share it if you feel comfortable? Yes, of course. You know what? My wife left me when? Like a few days ago. But I didn't want to tell you. I said, okay, you don't have to tell me. I don't make you compelled to tell me. But now, for the sake of a mutual dialogue, I would encourage you to share something with you, because then I would know where you stand. Because sometimes I wouldn't be able to help you out. I'm not a good helper, but actually there's no vertical connection between you and me, my friend. There's always horizontal, like this way. And so we feel towards each other. So, and they would open up and say. And then they would, sometimes they don't need to know all the teachings of the Buddha. Perhaps they only know, they need some guidance for anger management. So it's always Buddha encouraged. You know, when you look into the sutras, most of the teachings Buddha happened to give quite spontaneously. Patachara, when she lost her husband and children, and then so she became insane, and she was fully, he lost, and then she was fully naked. He ran to the Buddha, entered the temple, and please help me. And when Kisagotami, when her only child died, and he ran to the Buddha. When Daruchiriya, the merchant who got shipwrecked, and he didn't lost his, and he made his dress just to cover himself with the bark of the tree that he collected, and then so he went to the Buddha, then please help me. So always people ran to Buddha for help. And Buddha, and then quite spontaneously he had to give some solutions. And sometimes it would take few hours. Those long dialogues became the long sutras. And short dialogues like that only last like a couple of minutes, they become short sutras. So most of the time, whenever the divine beings has questions with dialogues with the Buddha, all the sutras were like maybe less than 2 minutes. Then I did some research. Why? Because they would appear and disappear as a question and disappear. They wouldn't stay because they are from another world, another being, and also their reasoning is very different. They would ask a straightforward question, and sometimes when they were based on intellectual abilities too. Some people were too intellectual. They incorporated a bunch of questions into one question. And Buddha had to ask several counter questions to get it clarified what question he must answer first. Or some people came up with very simple questions. Some came for a solution, and when they were asked, I don't know what I need. I don't know what I need. But you need something, my friend. Yes, I do, but I don't know what I need. Probably I need everything. What do you mean everything? So that is how. It's always, Buddha would first encourage people to reason out, to reason their problems. So, and he highly discouraged bhakti. Bhakti means blind faith. So there are two types of saddha or confidence or trust. Amulika, that is means baseless. That is more like bhakti or devotion. And he recommended akaravati, meaning trust or confidence based on reasoning. Americans call it verified faith. Because you need to get it verified. Why? What you need, whether you can trust this person. And then Buddha liked that. And then so Buddha never asked, okay, because he wanted people to first study what Buddha is, and he's first, he would say, Ehipassiko, come and see first. Not come and believe. Come and see. When Upali, who was a Jain follower, he was a follower of Mahavira, and he listened to one of the teachings of the Buddha, and he became, sir, please let me become one of your followers. And Buddha, and I need to say Buddha and Saranangach, I need to take refuge in you. And Buddha said, no, you don't have to. And second time, no, please, no, you don't have to. And third time, he said, no, you don't have to. And Buddha, it says that Buddha, ethically, Buddha wouldn't refuse more than three times. And Buddha got him promise, now, you are so excited to become a follower, but one condition. Continue to respect your former guru, former teacher. Otherwise, in case you insult him, and you are insulting Buddha at the first place, and so that you haven't transformed them. So that's how then he got Upali promise that he, Upali, still continued to respect his former guru. See the Buddha's ethical grounds. And the first thing Buddha would take into consideration is ethical limits.
That's, you're comfortable with that.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, cat boos and Jew boos.
What?
Cat boos, that's an American term. Cat boos means Catholic Buddhists.
Okay.
And there are Jew boos, Jewish Buddhists. my professor in Miami, he's a Jew boo. His wife is a Jew boo. They are liberal Jews, but they celebrate Vesak. They observe 8 precepts.
Yeah.
They do everything. And but they also observe Jewish Sabbath, also Passover too.
But that's in a cultural sense.
It's a cultural sense. But in his case, he says that he is not a culturally Jewish, and he is not culturally Buddhist. So he says that all my confidence, all my trust is in the scriptures. He teaches Torah. He taught me Torah and Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a point where you've got to decide which side of the fence you're on?
Exactly, that's right. When in high spiritual sense, there's a fine line between that.
Mm-hmm.
Now Buddha also encouraged that if you run after everything,
mm-hmm.
then you lose grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Be inquiring, have an inquisitive mind,
mm-hmm.
but when you believe in too many things, you may end up believing in accepting nothing.
There are parallels in the
teaching. Exactly, parallels, yeah. There are parallels, yeah. When I taught, compared to religion also, I my job was to teach 12 world religions, plus other native African and Latin American religions. So I prepared my syllabus based on the parallels.
Mm-hmm.
Parallels regarding salvation, nirvana, God, ethics, precepts, training, belief, and all the parallels. Yeah, when you go by parallels, actually you can very easily see where you are standing. When you see parallels, you are surrounded by a lot of things, but you are right in the middle. So, but nowhere has the Buddha said that only his teachings are true. Nowhere has he said that only his teachings are true. Buddha never wanted to claim that. Why? Otherwise he would have easily become the 63rd belief of his time. There were 62 already. He never wanted to be the 63rd one. So based on that, it's a way of understanding rather than like a domain of understanding. We call it Vimana in Pali. Vimana is the abode, divine abode. You know, the certain gods, they travel. They wherever they go, they travel in the Vidya Vimana, they are small palace things. And Buddha never wanted religion to be like that.
And so, isn't the parallels sometimes better with more classical philosophies?
Exactly, like
Stoicism or...
It could be misleading too. Mm.
Well, I mean, there are...
Yeah, philosophy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, in philosophy, so that's how there are different branches for this.
As well, there's quite a lot in Chinese philosophy as
yes.
well as...
Mm.
Greek classical,
yeah.
philosophy, and I think the ex-nun who writes on it, Karen Armstrong.
Karen, yeah, I love her.
Yeah,
Karen Armstrong. I read all her books.
Quite clearly about the Axis philosophers of 2,500
That's right,
years
yeah.
ago, and Buddha was in that, along with Jeremiah, the Jewish.
Yeah.
That, So I think the parallels there are.
That's right. Yeah.
More exact than virgin births and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah. See, I collect a lot of parallels about hell in Greek-Roman mythology, in Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, purgatory, and Chinese beliefs and all these things. Now, and I was able to come up with some universal terms to describe hells in all those religious beliefs. You are responsible for your actions. So you already create your hell through your actions, or you create your own heaven.
Well, whether it's the devil or Mara.
Mara, yeah, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how I like parallels, yeah. Mm-hmm. And within the same philosophy, there are lots of different branches, especially in philosophy. And then, so each branch... it's a result of breakaway. But however, when you put all those ideas, all those branches together again, and it makes sense. And when considered individually, and every branch makes sense.
But then there's no parallel for God or soul in Buddhism.
No, that's in Buddhism is considered defined based on cause and effect. Instead of God, cause and effect. Because Buddha uses the word cause and effect. Now, if there is something that has come to exist, it should have been created by one or a number of causes. So whatever is already existence has to end one day, sooner or later.
Except God.
Yeah, but so that's when Buddha didn't say that. Because when you say, in case somebody says except God, then Buddha have to go through another round of teaching. And simply he said everything is included in cause and effect. That's the answer Buddha gave. Everything's cause and effect.
I was just going to say on that I've Meister Eckhart, who was a Dominican?
Oh yeah, Dominican priest, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when he writes about God, you could remove the word God from his writings and they would still make sense.
Right,
but,
yeah.
And that's very...
Mm-hmm.
Give me a very Buddhist understanding.
That's right, yeah.
Especially of how he interpreted God. So even then, within these other traditions, there is certain ways of interpreting.
Interpreting, yeah.
What they mean. And a lot of...
Was the other one German then, what you referred the last time?
German,
yeah. Oppenheim. Oppenheim, yeah. And Thomas Aquinas says that he has a different argument. When you open up and say God... You open up your mouth to say there's no God. However, even if you haven't already verbalized the word God, when you open up to say the existence of deny the existence of God, thereby you accept the God is there. So that is when I like all these logics. And then I knew one Catholic priest in Sri Lanka. I think he passed away. He said he identified nature with God with nature. That's how he defined it. So that he had a lot of followers. And see that he has, and also my own professor at Harvard. So he said, I have faith, crisis in my faith. Now, I never used the word God. I never wanted to use it.
I think it's it depends on what agenda people have when they believe in a God, because ultimately my view is that if somebody insists on God, it's because they're obsessed with everlasting life and they want
it's true, yes.
So nature cannot give you everlasting life.
No, that's right. Nature is too broad, actually. And it is manifest to your naked eyes, yeah.
So what people would say that cause and effect is not going to give you everlasting life either, so you can't say that God in Christianity is the equivalent of cause and effect in Buddhism, because cause and effect is not going to give you everlasting life either, so you can't make that equation.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's what Buddha's answer. That's why it is different then.
Exactly, so I don't think it's a parallel.
Yeah, it's a different, yeah. The only thing, see, the middle grounds you have to consider is a parallel. Because you can match them. Match them and say, okay, this is right, this is wrong. Because Buddha respected other people's beliefs. It's only the parallels.
People worship Buddha as God. You know, these statues here and everything, and people come and bring work. So they are, in a sense, although they're not calling him God,
That's right. And Buddhism, because even though Buddhists don't believe in the creator God, they believe in the pantheon. And they would believe that God Chakra and others, when you are good and when you share the merits and there are gods, they could help you. So always there are alternatives. The thing is, and I think one of the sutras Buddha gave a very anthropological narrative of why people always believe in a higher power. That is in our genes. We always need non-sources. When the non-sources of help no longer are able to help us, we always look for an unknown higher power above us. So, and whatever that is, could be to a Buddhist, could be the God King Chakra or a benevolent devata who would share the merits and in turn he would take care of you. So somehow they believe. Yeah, that's why people bow down before a statue also. But what matters is in their mind they believe that. Now, there is someone, something that I can rely on. That I can depend on. So I think that's when professor from Chicago, and he write the books on the sacred and the profane. I forgot his name. And he says that when he traveled to Asia, he always saw a Buddhist temple in the mountain. And people, the more formidable, the taller the stupa or a pagoda was, there were more people going there. And the more difficult it was for them to climb a mountain for pilgrimage, and there are bigger lines, people, there are long lines to climb. So the more difficult the pilgrimage, and people would dedicate more time and they would consider it a once-in-a-lifetime chance to get there and worship. So, and also, I think maybe he or someone else talked about the sacred time too. Always time, centuries ago is always, a few millennia ago is the sacred time. Now, the time that we live right now, this is the weird time. But maybe in a thousand of time, thousands of years of later, future generations think, you know what? We heard about this gathering at London Buddhist Vihara and archaeological survey, so there was what is called temple. And there were these, the British people, and there was one monk, Sri Lankan also, they had this dialogue. I think that is the sacred, we miss that. Yeah. That is the sacred time. Like the people now say, we miss the Buddha's time. I love that, the concept of sacred time. Always the past is sacred, not the present. So in terms of sacred time, a higher power above us, and actually that is according to that anthropological sutra, I think maybe Kutadanta Sutra. That's how Buddha clearly explained, just like anthropologists do. When our primal ancestors saw the sun, right at the moment, when the sun disappears, moon appears. And when the sun is too much, there's no water. I feel it's hot. And so during the rain, it is cold. And they believe that all these things happen according to a timing. Now, there should be some gods in charge of these natural occurrences. And then they don't interfere with everyone else. Sometimes when there was a famine and all of a sudden there was heavy rainfall and after there was a flooding, and then people would think, okay, I think two gods are fighting. Mm-hmm. Definitely there's a higher god in charge overseeing all these gods. Mm-hmm. So first came to being was the polytheism. Then came monotheism. And Buddha give a beautiful anthropological narrative in one of the sutras when they will study that sutra. So that is when Buddha was very anthropological. Now, very humanistic, and he never wanted to, what is called, deify his character. But however, later now people have deified him. So Buddha, they have put the Buddha in such a place. Sorry, another one is uncertainty. Next one, yeah, a few more minutes. Uncertainty. That is vichikicca. Buddha talks about uncertainty regarding whether you existed, whether you had a past life, whether you're going to have an afterlife, whether there is someone called Buddha, whether someone is able to achieve nirvana, whether there is something called salvation, whether there is something called karma, does karma bring results? So whether universe is permanent, whether there are other beings out there, and there's a number of philosophical questions. So the uncertainty, surrounded by uncertainty. But here, for applicant purpose, we can apply this one, uncertainty, in our day-to-day lives. Now, if you get swayed by someone, too many ideas, when you find it difficult to stay on decisions, and you always go back on your decisions, and you usually get swayed by other people's opinion, and there's a probability that we can get obsessed with uncertainty, vichikicca, those who get swayed by. And in order to counter vichikicca, and Buddha recommends that dialogues, you know, mutual dialogues, Buddha recommends for uncertainty. Always good to listen to someone or to share with someone. Vichikicca. But again, vichikicca and ditti, so uncertainty and view, they are like twin actually. Some people believe in, they remain uncertain, but they never want to listen to someone to learn further. Back and forth, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. I know one of my uncles, he's obsessed with uncertainty. He never wants to get his ideas clarified. So even the head monk of the village temple reprimanded him many times, because they were very good friends, actually. You will never learn, man. You are now 75, you will never going to learn. And because he loves uncertainty, he did a lot of satisfaction. Well, so-and-so says that, well, that is right. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. No, that doesn't make any sense. What he says, that makes more sense. What he says is makes sense, but what he says is make much less sense. He make more sense. Both are right. I think no, actually they are wrong. Both wrong. That's the way he talks too. He's a man of uncertainty. That's according to the head monk of his temple. But it is an obsession. He never wants to get things. He never wants to clear his mind of some clear ideas. He never wanted that. On social level. So
how do you cut that off?
You need to work with a good friend. You need to do that. But my uncle is so stubborn. the head monk said he's an ample example of spiritual stubbornness. He's absolute spiritual stubborn. And then he gets tired too. So far, and he said he has listened to like thousands of talks, been to different meditation retreats. After the retreat, he gets angry. No, that's not the right retreat. Again, he goes another. No, that's not the right one. So now he's 76, I guess. But that's his way. No, he's obsessed with uncertainty, vichikicca. So getting swayed by. And he also said that now, for a few days or for the moment they listen to someone, and he would say, he is way better than Buddha. But the next day, a few days later, you would see him strolling down the street, cursing, or say, you know what, I don't believe in that man. So that's how he is. So his grandchildren make fun of him. Our grandpa would never learn. I said, no, that's his age, respect him. That's his belief. So next one, the last one is conceit, mana. Mana is, conceit is different than pride. Now, pride we use as Buddhist terms, you can be proud of your achievements. Whereas, when you are too much of you, when you boast about, and then you say, if you are the only one in the world knowing all those things, that's conceit. So, pride, in a highly spiritual Buddhist sense, pride is also considered detrimental to spiritual progress. However, on the conventional level, pride is considered a good term, and it is defined as by comparison. Compared with conceit, pride is a good word. Pride. In English, I'm proud of you, right? So, but never conceitful. Conceit is not. Conceit is, because of conceit, you aggrandizing others, oneself and despise others. You always promote yourself and despise others, belittle others. That's the tendency of created by conceit. I am the one knowing everything. Don't question me like this. Now, and it's insecurity. And conceit is always fed by avijja, ignorance. Avijja. So basically, our time is up. Give me one second. Okay, thank you for your participation today. See you next.